We're going to start the meeting. We do not have a quorum yet. But and we'll make some other motions when we get a quorum. We need one more to come in for a quorum. Several meetings are going on at the same time, so we will try our best to coordinate different people. And let's start with Representative Clark. Was in early. This is Senate File 1537, and we'll explain the bill, and then we'll have to take any action.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Clark, if you just explain your bill, and then I noticed you have some amendments at all. We'll have to postpone those amendments until.
I just have one amendment, Mr. Chairman. It's the 812. I don't know why the other document is there. It's just.
Okay.
Can't hear me? Okay. I just have one amendment. And it's a. Do you want me to explain the bill or the.
Yeah, why don't you explain the bill? And members, their fiscal note should be in your packet. Okay, we do have a quorum? We have a quorum now?
We
have a quorum, so we'll call the meeting to order. The first thing is approval of the minutes.
So moved.
Representative Carlson moves the minutes of April 21st. Any corrections, additions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And carried. Representative Carlson, do you have a motion?
Would you like my omnibus motion?
Yeah.
I will make that motion then, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 2562, House File 3033, House Senate File 2471, House File 3046, House File 3790, and Senate File 1537 be recommended to pass and placed on the general orders.
We thought maybe we'd get through this meeting really fast. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I suspect I should withdraw that motion. Being that Representative Clark does probably want to tell about her bill.
Yeah. Okay. But Representative Carlson would move Senate File 1537, bidding it before us. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just review for the committee. This Senate file is before you because actually the House file was on the House floor some time ago, and in the Senate, this bill actually brings together two parts of two different bills in the Senate. One of them has to do with requiring a certificate of need for the high voltage transmission line that's proposed to be by Xcel to be constructed through the heart of inner city South Minneapolis Phillips neighborhood down the Greenway, what is known as the Midtown Greenway. We've been working with Xcel for a number of months on this, we being in the community, the neighborhood, the city, the county, and others who are concerned about it. And we've come up with an agreement that's reflected in this bill. And what you need to know is that bill has the certificate of need being in Section 1. In Section 2, it has a neighborhood energy reduction report. What this is about is the other part of another Senate bill that is also in an omnibus bill, I believe, that calls for a study of the situation that this is the reason that Xcel says is why they want to put up this high voltage transmission line. And that is that there is a supposed deficit of 55 megawatts in the area. What we want to do in this study is look at whether or not those megawatts could be created by both alternative renewable energy and savings, conservation and energy efficiency, and all sorts of new kinds of things that are being proposed right now in the energy community. So that report would be generated. There would be a community steering committee that would guide it. The energy savings would accrue to the utility, which they would deserve to get, and then we would hear a report back on the results of that study to the legislature. And it is set up to work in tandem with what's going on right now, which is a contested case hearing on the siting of those transmission lines that is going on right now at the Public Utilities Commission. So, Mr. Chairman, the amendment that's before you reflects some requests from the Department of Commerce. In the Finance Committee, they let us know that they would rather have the funding go to the City of Minneapolis rather than be housed in the Department of Commerce. And so the language that is in the A12 amendment, I believe it is?
Yeah, there's two amendments in our packages, but the A10 amendment is incorporated in A12.
Yeah,
So all we need to worry about is A12.
Yes.
So, Representative Carlson, would you be so kind as to move the A12 amendment?
Yes, I'll move the amendment for A12, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, then it's before us. And members, as this came through, besides what Representative Clark has indicated in the amendment, there were some other concerns expressed in finance by members, both sides of the political aisle, and I think she has addressed those as well. Do you want to tell us about those?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. One of the other issues was to delete the reference to child care and transportation that was in the that's to help the citizens that are participating, and just put down, replace it with reasonable expenses. There are no per diem payments. We made that clear in this. The folks that would be working with the city, which is again where the Department of Commerce would like to see the money transfer, they want it transferred to the City of Minneapolis. The folks that would be working with the city are spelled out here. Those that would be helping consult with them to determine how this, who would do the study and how it would be done, would be the Midtown Greenway Coalition and representatives of the neighborhoods in which the high voltage transmission line is proposed to be sited. And that's, as far as I know, this is still in agreement with everyone. There's one other one, small one on page 1, line 10. Our House research staff indicated we should change the word one quarter to one half, and that refers to one half mile rather than one quarter mile from the bike path, because that's what the GIS map indicated would be needed. There wasn't just an error in looking at it before. So that's the amendment, and as far as I know, there's no opposition to it or to the bill at this point.
Any discussions on questions on the amendment? So put it in the form that the author wants it. All those in favor of the A12 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And carried. Questions from members? Any questions? No. Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Clark, did your amendment change anything relative to the fiscal note that's in our bill or in our packet here?
Representative Holbrook, no, it did not.
And if I might, can you explain to us who pays into this special revenue fund?
Representative Clark.
As I recall, the Renewable Development Fund is what you're talking about. That was created in an agreement with Xcel Energy back when the casks at Perry Island were expanded there, and there was an agreement that there would be this RDF fund that would continue to be paid into every year. So it is paid into by Xcel.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, so was it was like the ratepayers?
Yes.
Paid more to
eventually
fund this?
Oh, no, this is not a new part of the fund. This is existing money that is there. I didn't explain that.
Representative Clark, let's have fiscal staff clarify that to make sure. I think it may be the fund is there, but I think the assessment that goes into the fund is a new assessment, I think.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm actually not sure if it's a new assessment or not. Perhaps there's someone else here who can explain that.
Okay. Thank you for being here, and welcome to the committee, if you can identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members, I am Bill Glahn, Deputy Commissioner of Commerce for Energy, and to answer, Mr. Chair, Representative, to answer your question.
Can I interrupt a bit?
Sure.
Could you spell your last name?
G-L-A-H-N.
Thank you.
Not even close. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook. To answer your question, there two things going on here in this fiscal note. One is the funds to pay for the study, and that was what Representative Clark was discussing, $100,000 to be transferred to the city of Minneapolis to pay for the study for the local neighborhood of energy requirements. And that's coming from the fund that Xcel Energy ratepayers pay into in relation to the casks at Prairie Island and Monticello. And so this bill doesn't change that. I think we're going to hear another bill that might make some changes to that later on in this hearing. But so that wouldn't raise rates to ratepayers because they're already paying into this fund. It would take money out of that fund and repurpose it for this study. Now, the rest of it, as a result of amendments we made in the Finance Committee, its last stop, would be billed. It represents the litigation costs of the Minnesota Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission associated with the Certificate of Need proceeding that Section 1 of the bill calls for. And that money would be billed to Xcel ratepayers as well as whatever litigation cost Xcel would incur in association with the Certificate of Need proceeding. So that would be billed back to ratepayers. So there's two different pools of money being tapped for this bill.
And Mr.
Representative Holbrook.
Chair, if I might... two things. The $100,000 that's in an existing fund, in general, what is that fund used for and what won't be able to be done if we take $100,000 out of it? And what's the balance of that fund? And then the second part of it, can you explain to me? My understanding is that you have to get approval for rate increases, et cetera. As the bill is written, does it automatically allow for a rate increase to cover these costs, or will they have to go through the process to get a rate increase with the PUC in order to assume these additional costs?
Mr. Glahn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, to answer your second question first, this would have to still go through the Public Utilities Commission rate-setting process. There's not an automatic pass-through of those litigation costs. It would be rolled into the cost of whatever facilities got built or their general rate case cost would be my suspicion. To answer your second question, perhaps Xcel Energy could give you the account balances. We don't administer that fund. Xcel Energy administers the fund. They would be better positioned to give you the account balances. I guess at the risk of hearsay, I believe they testified in the last case there was sufficient funds for this amount of money. And basically what would happen is that money wouldn't be available for competitive bids for other projects that might want to use this money. There's been a few rounds of competitive bidding where folks come in and propose projects to be paid for out of these funds, and that would reduce the amount that would be available for future disbursement to winners of these competitive bidding processes.
And Mr. Chair, just real briefly, who or what organizations would be typical requesters of this fund, and for what types of purposes?
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me, I would ask Mr. Evans to help me out because we've quickly gotten beyond my depth on this.
It's time for phone a friend.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Evans, if you can identify yourself for the team.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. The Renewable Development Fund has a number of different purposes. There's an ongoing appropriation out of the fund for the University of Minnesota IRE, which is a renewable energy study organization over at the University of Minnesota. What typically has been happening with the fund over the years since it was established is we would put out requests for proposals for. It can be anything from studies of new renewable energy. It can be renewable energy projects that need money, pilot projects to get going. It goes to universities. It goes to, you know, individuals who are developing projects. They're selected by a committee that's made up of Xcel Energy plus some environmental groups plus some other representatives on a board, and they make grants. There's about $15 million or so that the committee wanted to make grants out of next year. This will not, the $100,000 obviously will not impact that very much. When you get to Representative Rukavina's bill, then we're talking about some more significant money coming out of that $15 million. So and that may jeopardize, as you'll probably discuss when you discuss that bill, you know, how many grants can be awarded. But this $100,000, frankly, is not. We pay. I should let you know. We pay, I think, about $16 million a year into the fund because of the dry cask storage that we have at our two nuclear plants. That number will go up in 2012, I believe, because we'll put some more casks out at Monticello, so that escalates the number. So,
Representative Holbert?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Evans, if you know, then what is the renewable energy component of this study?
Mr. Evans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, what the study is going to look at is two things. That is opportunities for energy conservation and opportunities for renewable energy in the area where this transmission line will be constructed.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might, then the second part about the litigation costs that would be billed to the XL rate payers. Is the way the bill's written, you will do these things and you may or may not be able to recoup the cost through the rates? That would be dependent on the PUC approving the additional money, or how will that work?
Well,
Mr.
just,
Evans?
Mr. Chair, give you a little bit of background. Anytime we build a large facility, including a transmission line, we have to get a certificate of need from the Public Utilities Commission demonstrating to them that we need to build the facility. This line is so short that it actually fits under an exemption, so we don't ordinarily have to get a certificate of need. What this bill would require us to do if it becomes law is require us to get a certificate of need on this particular line and other lines that would be nearly identical to this one. Those costs, I mean, we're not frankly very concerned that those costs would not be passed through. The Public Utilities Commission, you know, will reimburse or allow us to reimburse ourselves for costs that we're required to bear to do our business. And if state law tells us we have to do something, that's a pretty good argument that we were required to bear that cost. So it's not done until the PUC orders it, but we aren't concerned about the ability to recover those costs.
All right, thank you.
Other questions? Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, so what is the net effect? I'm trying to understand. You don't need a certificate of need under normal conditions. The PUC could just grant the building of this line. And so what the net effect is of this legislation is the ratepayers, assuming PUC reimburses you, how much will be the total net effect to the ratepayers?
Mr. Evans?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I don't really know the answer to that question. We go through certificate of need processes all the time for our facilities. This one will, you know, require filings and require staff work. I'm afraid I don't know the answer as I sit here today with how much that cost would be.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Evans, is the study to figure out if the line should be built underground or above ground, because there's significant cost differences in that, or is the study to see if they can stop the construction of the line at all?
Mr. Evans?
Mr. Chair, the proponents of the legislation in XL are probably of two different views on that question. We think the study will find opportunities for renewable energy and for conservation, which will be good things in and of themselves. Our engineers, including our conservation experts and our renewable energy experts, don't think that there is a ghost of a chance that we would be able to prevent the construction of the line. There's just not that much conservation and renewable energy available there. The proponents of the bill think that they will be able to find that much. I guess from our point of view, we'll find some good conservation opportunities and some good renewable opportunities, and that will be good. But I think the proponents, other proponents of the project of the study would tell you they think they're going to find enough energy to forego the need for the line, and our folks just don't think that's possible.
Okay, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Evans, if you were to agree or if the PUC was to require you to put it underground, what's the increased cost to building a line of this length underground instead of above ground, or are you willing to build it underground?
Mr. Evans, you got some signals.
Our estimate is that the difference in cost between overhead and underground would be about $12 million. Under current law, if the city of Minneapolis were to require us to put the line underground, we would put the line underground, and the our customers within the city of Minneapolis would bear that cost. The PUC could also order us to put it underground based on certain criteria, and they could order us to share the cost among all of our customers. Or all of the parties could get together and negotiate an equitable arrangement for putting the line underground if that was the decision they made. So it can happen a number of different ways.
Representative McNamara.
Just the last one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And have you agreed or been required to build lines in similar situations like this underground?
Yes, we have. There have been circumstances where we've buried the line.
Representative Kahn?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, I think this bill is fine the way it stands. Let me tell you one frustration that I have with the difficulties in deciding to go underground. First of all, this problem is that we only look at the cost of the immediate construction. We don't look at the cost avoidance. And I think one has found that there are significant, you know, I'm sure the people in the field know this better than I do, but the difficulty that we've had with overhead lines in the terms of naturally occurring disasters, and I don't think there's been significant problems with underground lines. So if one could look at cost avoidance over a longer period of time, that would be helpful. The other thing is looking at that cost avoidance. When a power line comes down and it needs to get repaired and there are all kinds of costs, I assume all the ratepayers pay for it, not just the ones in the area where it came down. I guess that's a question. That's
Mr. Evans?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct, yes.
Well, you know, again, that shows if putting a line underground avoids those kinds of costs, I think it would be something that's fair for the entire ratepayers to pay, not just the ones in the immediate vicinity that would benefit for that. But that's questions that go beyond the scope of this bill. I just wanted to make it.
I want to keep in mind we're here for the fiscal notes, and you know, but the questions I think are very appropriate so far. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Evans. Representative Clark mentioned earlier that maybe not peace in the valley on this, but there's an agreement on this bill now. Is that an accurate statement that you're okay with this bill going forward, that most of your objectives are been taken care of?
Mr. Evans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we don't really want to be characterized as supporters of the bill, but we think that a certificate of need, you know, can be appropriate in cases like this, and we believe we can do one. We were mostly concerned that it not delay the project, which we think ultimately is going to have to be built, and we think there's safeguards in the bill to make sure that happens. And again, the cost of the study, while we don't think it's going to have the result that the proponents think it's going to have, we do think the good will come out of it, and so we can support that use of RDF money for that purpose.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other pressing questions? If not, Representative Carlson renews his motion that Senate File 1537, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed in the General Registry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
And carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, just an announcement. Senate File 2471, the Winkler bill for the Secretary of State's fighting, will be removed from the agenda tonight. So if anybody's here for that, it'll be here. Placed on the agenda for tomorrow at the author's request. Then let's go down. Let's see. Representative Rukavina. I think he's in the audience.
Not on the agenda. Oh, here.
Representative Files, would you like to make a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move
House File 3033, recommended be passed and moved to the General Register.
Representative Rukavina, you've heard the motion. You want to explain your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Quickly, this is a bill that is basically about jobs, as I've always wanted to talk about, and making things in Minnesota. It's about green jobs. It uses some of the renewable development fund that you were just talking about to offer a rebate for Minnesota citizens who put solar or photovoltaic cells on their homes of up to 40 kilowatts. And basically, it lowers the payback to make it more attractive, hopefully to about 5 years for a homeowner. Other states like Washington State that have had a program like this have seen a jump in their the number of homes that are taking advantage of it and feeding the grid. And it would be, it's been worked out with Excel. You can't sell this to anybody other than their buyback, the way that they buy back electricity, and also that it's just for the Excel service area, because that was an issue that was brought up by a number of legislators. I had it as a statewide bill. I know Representative Westrum doesn't like that, but neither did Representative Beards or Hackbarth like it, that the money was going to other service areas because of the Excel payment for Prairie Island. So that's basically the bill, members. It's $2 million out of, I believe, if you take the Monticello cast, maybe $19 million in the first year, and then $4 million the second, and $5 million out there in the third and fourth, and I believe fifth year. And that's the bill.
Questions on the bill? Any questions on the bill? Representative Westrum?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina is right. I do still I'm not content with just limiting it to the Excel territory. We haven't done that with the RDF before, and I don't think we should start now, but I don't have an amendment today, Representative Rukavina.
Good.
I just want to let members know that, and feel free to vote no.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Rukavina, if I have this right, my neighbors are going to pay a rate increase so that a solar plant, maybe on the Iron Range, maybe down in Representative Hamilton's district, will take the money that we pay to subsidize their business?
No, that's not at all accurate, Representative McNamara. You shouldn't be so paranoid. You know, be like me. I'm never paranoid about anybody taking money. But no.
No, he's not.
No, what this is the money's already going into the fund, and Representative Hilty did increase the cask price, I believe, by the $16 million annually to a per cask now, which basically is the same but will increase as the Monticello casks are stored. But it is to go back and put solar panels. There's already a rebate program offered by Excel, which this will piggyback on. And this is about using money, Representative McNamara, using some of that money that you're already paying in as a ratepayer to actually accomplish what the Rural Renewable Development Fund was about, and that's fixing up ways to use a renewable source of energy for electricity. Now, you know, I mean, I'm not criticizing any of the other uses, but right now you have a committee, and I don't see Representative Hilty on here, and so maybe somebody else can help me out. Maybe Representative Westrum knows, where people give out grants, and you've given out, since the cycle began, a lot of money via your constituents' payments to Excel for a number of things, like $1 million for a California company to study about photovoltaic cells, and $1.2 million to a General Electric wind turbine in Iowa, and $500,000 almost for a biomass co-firing sponsored by the University of North Dakota. And so that money has gone out already for a number of things, and I think, being me, I get a little hyper and want something to actually happen. And so this actually accomplishes what the goal, I think, of the Renewable Development Fund was all along, and that it has people putting in their homes a renewable source of energy. and it buys the payback now, which is kind of unattractive, but when you use this and have the program that's already in place with Excel, and I believe some other programs that may be available at the Department of Commerce, and piggyback it on the federal tax breaks that are now available, you'll make it more attractive to homeowners to actually do this, and they'll pay it off maybe in 6 years or so instead of, you know, 15 or so, and it makes it actually happen. So that's what I'm trying to do. And yes, in the process, if Representative Hamilton and Representative Rukavina has a factory, right now there are two factories in the state, and they're both happen to be in the metro area. And they're okay with this. I don't think Excel opposes this. Whereas, there, do you oppose it? I don't think so. No, he's not saying anything. But and we worked it out with everyone, and that's what it does.
Representative McNamara.
Just one more quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. But isn't there a current competitive grant process that this is kind of stepping in and saying we're going to send it in this direction? So what does it do to that money that's currently going to this competitive grant process? If you take the money for this program, are we increasing that the fees going into that, or is that going to be delayed, or is there not going to be, there can't be as much if you're going to take it away?
Mr. Chair, what we are doing is, instead of having a competitive grant process for thinking about doing something, we're actually doing it. That's what I would phrase it as.
And
Mr.
Chair, the other way to phrase it is, you're superseding the competitive grant process and saying this is what we're going to do.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Yes, that's what we do as lawmakers.
Okay.
Other questions? If not, then Representative Faust renews his motion that House File 3033, you recommend to pass and place in the general registry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Carried. Next on the agenda, let's see. Representative Rude, you're on the committee, so if that's okay, we take Representative Murphy. Jump around. Representative, I also want to make a motion for Representative Murphy.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 3790. Recommend it to pass and move to the general register.
You've heard the motion. Welcome to the committee, Representative Murphy, if you would be so kind as to explain your bill. And I noticed that there are some amendments on it. Do you, are they your amendments?
No, they are not, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Okay, let's explain your bill then first, and then we'll handle the amendments. Members, in your packet should be a fiscal note and a House research. I guess it's not a fiscal note, it's a spreadsheet. I don't see the spreadsheet. So do you have a spreadsheet? We're checking to make sure we get the spreadsheet. I thought it would be kind of nice to have it. So, Bill's taking a look at it. We got it. We'll make copies of it and have it in there. We apologize for not having that in there. Packet. Representative Murphy, why don't you, while we're doing that, explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 3790 reflects the work of the Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division. It was developed as a committee bill, and that is what is before you today. Very briefly, this bill includes House File 2882 by Representative Hansen, which is Article 1, and House File 3502 as amended by Representative Wagenius, Article 2. House File 1086, which is part of Article 3, Section 1, which came from Representative Wagenius and the the Finance Committee on Environment, and House File 3258 by Representative Beard, which is Article 3, Section 2. It also includes few technical corrections regarding the logo and carryover funds. I think it's important to note that in Article 1, all of the funding levels recommended by the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council are recommended for passage. We did incorporate a few policy changes that incorporate some of the suggestions that were made to address concerns raised during the review process. We spent quite a bit of time reviewing the project so that we would know what they were and what we were going to improve in our environment in the next few years. Given the jurisdiction of the Ways and Means Committee, I'm confining my remarks to the spending totals and whether they fit in with the current budget parameters, and they do. The bill primarily affects two of the funds, the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Clean Water Fund. And the fund balance after the appropriations that we make this year to the Outdoor Heritage Fund leaves a balance of about $9.7 million. The Clean Water Fund, after the recommended appropriations, we will have about $2.7 million left in the Clean Water Fund. Article 2 also contains a $1.074 million in revenues to serve as the required match for Metro groundwater monitoring and reuses $5 million in funds provided for the PCA last year that were not authorized this year. Article 3 contains estimated impact on funds to cover the Beard provision in Article 3. The amounts that are contained in this bill fall within the fund balances and so should be recommended to pass. I ask for your support.
Okay, there are some amendments that are in our packets, members, and they're drafted to the wrong version of the bill, a couple of them. But
you have the right
numbers. Kathy will make some oral exchange. So we have A3, A4, and A8. Let's just start with the A3. Is that someone's amendment?
My amendment.
Of Representative Faust. Representative Faust removes the amendment H3790A3. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an oral amendment to it.
Just one second, Kathy. How do we need to change that to fit in?
Mr. Chair, on page 1, line 2, instead of line 24, it should be line 30. And on line 3 of the amendment, instead of delete lines 25 to 27, it should be 31 to 33. Okay. And on line 4, it should read page 25, line 1.
Do members have that amendment? Now, Representative Faust, you have another oral amendment?
No, that was my oral amendment.
Okay, very good. Okay, Representative Faust moves the A3 amendment as corrected. Representative Faust, would you be so kind as to explain your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that this bill does is that it increases the fee on irrigation wells that farmers in the 11-county metro area are doing, and it increases the fee by approximately $360 per well. And so, I mean, you can really easily do the math. The farmer could have 5 or 10 of these wells out there. And if he's got 10 wells, that's $3,600 increase fees that one farmer is going to have to pay. And so that just seems to me to be a little bit excessive for a fee on one person. By contrast, the fee on the metro residents will be 22 cents per year. per person in the metro. And so you can see there's a huge difference between what one farmer may have to pay compared to one resident inside the metro area. This amendment is supported by the Minnesota Farmers Union, Minnesota Farm Bureau, and the Irrigators Association. And there's $5 million from the constitutional amendment going into this. And I just think that, you know, we really should use that money first. And once that runs out, then let's start looking at fees like this. But let's first see how far that goes and if that takes care of this. And I guess the last point I'd make is that, you know, this is a matching money as a fee. And I doubt that most people, when they voted for the 3/4 cent constitutional amendment on the sales tax increase, that they were expecting there to be a fee increase anywhere going along with that. So that's the reason for the amendment, and I would urge your support.
Okay, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, last year's bill, we had some geological atlases and some test projects throughout the state in rural Minnesota, and where they were done, the counties had to match the funds that came from our bill. And so we were using that same premise for the metropolitan area. But this provision did come from originally from the Environment Finance Committee, and Representative Wagenius is here and can talk a lot more about it than I can right now.
Representative Wagenius, do you want to give us your input?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I think Representative Murphy brings up the first good point, and that is that for most of the funds from the clean water, there is a match. When we sent money out through Bowser, which we sent out about $18 million, matching funds were required. The most parallel thing to what we're doing here is the Geologic Atlas, which looks at a county by county and how much groundwater is in that county. And for that, there are always a match. So in the Greater Minnesota is paying a matching fund. So to be fair, we decided, well, why should the metro get off for free? I mean, it is a fairness issue. So the matching fund is a 0.008 cent a gallon fee, which Representative Baus does correctly say for a person is about 20, 25 cents a year. And that is so you will have wells in the metro area that can tell you if we are running out or low in water. Okay. It also applies to some other wells. Mainly it's city wells, and these city wells are the ones that pay the fee, and it's spread out. But there are agricultural wells. And an agricultural well, a sprinkler system, can use up to 45 million gallons of water a year, which is the exact same as a whole bunch of our cities. So they pay a flat fee of $140 for using 45 million gallons of water. So what this fee does, if you look at it, you can look at it on a big fee, the one way, or you can look at it, it's per acre, what does this fee raise? So here's let me give you some very specifics here. A lot of these wells are in Sherburne County. There are already problems in Sherburne County with water. The competition between agriculture and housing. And we don't know how fast the water is being drawn down. We don't know how fast it's being recharged. So it's in a farmer's best interest. I don't think there are many farmers who'd like to pass along land to a son or a daughter and say, well, here's the land, but there's no more water underneath it, and it won't be any good for farming anymore. So fair, folks in agriculture, just like other folks, pay the fee. So here's what it amounts to. if you are farming potatoes, which is probably the reason you have a center point pivot well, your gross income for that acreage in 2007 was $2,595 an acre in 2007. In 2008, it was $3,420 an acre. What does this fee amount to an acre? At tops, if you're in a dry year and you use all the water, it's $2.57 an acre. You have to have context here. If it's a wet or medium year, you're probably paying $1.18 an acre, $1.18 an acre. This is not a mandatory fee. This is a use fee only. If you use the water, you pay the fee. If you don't use the water, you don't pay the fee. So if you were to repeal, and you'll see this, the agriculture fee and just save it for households, then what will happen is the households will have to be subsidizing the agriculture. It's just one of those issues we're going to come down to, and the choice is, do households subsidize agriculture in this way? So bottom line, what we're doing is we're buying a group of what are called non-stressed wells, which can tell you how much water is left in the metro aquifers. The whole bill for this is not $5 million. It's over $8 million. So the fee pays for some of the wells, and then it pays ongoing maintenance. These wells are going to be automatic. I mean, a person doesn't go out. They're electronically done, and it all goes to a central location so you know how much water you have left in your aquifer. So it's about $850,000 a year is the ongoing. So once all the wells are in, the fee in the bill drops to 0.0006 cent a gallon. The League of Cities has come out in support of this. We know we need to know how much water we have and whether our children will have water, whether our grandchildren will have water. It's awfully hard for us to do long-term planning because we're a two-year legislature. And unfortunately, I have run into a long-term planning issue, but that's what we're doing. With that, I would oppose the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that what you're doing here is actually a very good thing. I agree with you that we need to find that out. But you mentioned that we should do this on a per acre basis, and you know most developments out in that side of the country, you know, that far out from metro, you're looking at approximately 2 acres or less per household, which would be 80 per 160 acres, and a well will irrigate 160 acres. So if you do the math on that, we should increase the well for an irrigation well by $17.60 instead of $360. So I could live with that if you want to make that change, but I think otherwise that the farmers really are paying a disproportionate high amount per well.
Representative Javits.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm going to speak in support of the FOST amendment. I like the bill overall. In committee, I wasn't real big on this water fee in here, and I think the examples, we can give all sorts of examples about making $3,000 per acre on potatoes. I could also give you the example of a lot of corn land down in Dakota County where they're losing $50 to $200 an acre, and then you add another fee upon that. And we talk about children and grandchildren and so forth, but just a question to Representative Wagenius, if there is a drop in the water tables, what do we do then? Do we take water from Mississippi, or what do we do? If we find that there's a drop in water tables, are we going to start rationing water, or what happens?
Representative Wagenius?
I can tell you where in the water. You're asking a far more complex question than I can answer. Mr. Lacismo is here from DNR. But we don't know where the water is going to drop too much or any place. But the, I would say that Sherburne County is one of the more vulnerable places, and it's vulnerable because there are already stresses between agriculture and cities. But more importantly, the Mount Simon-Hinckley aquifer thins out, and half of Sherburne County doesn't even have that aquifer. So they're just using shallow aquifers right now. So I can't tell you in any given location because it's all different. In Dakota County, the aquifer is very deep. In Sherburne, it's very shallow. So you are beyond my expertise, but I for sure know that we won't know how to deal with it if we don't know what we're dealing with it. You can't manage what you don't measure. Every businessman will tell you that.
Thank you, Representative. We're going to see Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
To Representative Faust, did you say, Representative Faust, that the Minnesota Farmers Union and the Farm Bureau both support your amendment?
That's correct.
Okay. Somebody say something about being paranoid around here. Mr. Chairman, I'm not paranoid. It just seems like everybody's after me. But with that being said, generally when those two groups get together, it's probably an amendment some members might consider supporting.
Either that or it's bad, one or the other.
Could be.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, I really like your Article 1, the beginning of the bill. In regards to this section, Representative Faust, thank you for the amendment. I think it's important for folks to know that these fees have recently been increased 40%. I think it may have been 2 or 3 years ago. We increased well permits from $100 to $140. So they recently had a 40% increase, and now this would be in the neighborhood of potentially for some 300% increase. And Representative Wagenius, I have one question. Do you know if the pump-out well proposed in Washington County, where they're going to propose to pump 8 or 9 million gallons a day, would be subject to this fee?
Representative Wagenius?
I suspect not, but I'd have to ask Mr. Lacusmo that question.
Mr. Lacusmo, can you be so kind as to come down?
Would you take the
stand, please? It's not quite a judicial stand yet, but come back and get more than a shake of the head so we have your recorded the question.
Mr. Chair, while he's coming, I would just like to say that I wasn't aware that there was any amendments this evening, and neither of these two farm agencies came to visit.
Representative Mr. Lacusmo, would you identify yourself for the tape, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kent Lacusmo, Director of the Division of Waters for DNR.
And do you need the question repeated?
Mr. Chairman, I understand the question, Mr. McNamara. This would apply to all groundwater users, so those pump outs would be paying a fee.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would hope at the very least, Representative Wagenius, that we would not require look at that. And I just think that shows this issue is very complex, and I just think it's inappropriate. We just 2 years ago passed a 0.375% increase for clean water. We have hundreds of millions of dollars available, and now we're going to go and pick on the farmers in my area and the farmers in Representative Faust's area and tell them they should pay a 300% increase for their irrigation wells. And you can talk about 3,000 or whatever, how many dollars an acre they get for potatoes, but the best rent we get is $300 an acre, and we have to take care of the irrigation system. So we don't get thousands and thousands of dollars an acre for rent when we get it. That's for potatoes. You get a little more. You get a couple hundred if you're lucky for corn. These guys are struggling today, and to be nailing us this way when we just passed an amendment with hundreds of millions of dollars available. Thank you, Representative Faust. This is the right thing to do, and we should get this fee off.
Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we'll have a roll call on this one tonight.
Roll call has been requested. Other questions? Any other questions? A roll call has been requested. Everyone understand the amendment? The clerk will take the roll.
Solberg?
No.
Abler?
Yes.
Breinert?
No.
Bunn?
No.
Carlson?
No.
Davids?
Yes.
Dean? Demmer?
Yes.
Eakin?
Yes.
Faust?
Yes.
Hamilton?
Yes.
Hillstrom?
No.
Holberg?
Yes.
Hoppy? Huntley? Kahn?
No.
Lemjeski?
No.
Mahoney? Mariani?
No.
McNamara?
Yes.
Nelson?
No.
Otremba? Rude?
No.
Scalzi?
No.
Swales? Tilbury? Westrom?
Yes.
There being 10 ayes and 11 nays, the amendment is not adopted. We have another amendment in the, let's go to A4, if you would please. And that has to be fixed as well?
Yes.
So, Kathy?
Mr. Chair, on page 1, line 2 of the amendment, it should read line 29. Mm-hmm.
Oh, instead of page 29, is that correct?
No, it should be page
29. Oh, page 29, line 29. Thank you. Okay, page 29, line 29. And is this your amendment, Mr.
Yes, Paul? It is, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pauls, want to move the amendment?
Yes, please. I'll move the A4 amendment.
Okay, we have that before us. Representative Pauls, would you explain your amendment?
This bill does basically exactly the same thing. It just says that the fee that is being charged in the bill does not go on to water that is used for agriculture irrigation.
Okay. Any other discussion on the Representative Wagenius?
Just as a matter of fairness, this is strictly a user fee, so the agriculture interests get the money for, get the work done for free, then the households will have to pay for it.
Any other discussion? Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just everybody needs to realize in agriculture we're dealing in commodities, and there's no way to pass this additional expense onto the end user of our products. So just a point that everybody needs to take into consideration.
Sure. Representative Westrom?
Mr. Chair, I just asked for a roll call on this amendment.
Roll call has been requested. Any other discussion? The clerk will take the roll.
Solberg?
No.
Abler?
Yes.
Breinert?
No.
Bunn?
No.
Carlson?
No.
Davids?
Yes.
Dean? Demmer?
Yes.
Eakin?
Yes.
Faust?
Yes.
Hamilton?
Yes.
Hillstrom?
No.
Holberg?
Yes.
Hoppy? Huntley? Kahn?
No.
Lemjeski?
No.
Mahoney? Mariani?
No.
McNamara?
Yes.
Nelson?
No.
Otremba?
Yes.
Rude?
No.
Scalzi?
No.
Swales? Tilbury? Westrom?
Yes.
There being 10 ayes and 11 nays, the amendment does not prevail. I have another amendment in the desk. It's at 08. Is that Representative Eakin?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is the amendment that I discussed with you and Representative Wagenius earlier, and it is dealing with policy issues, so I will withdraw that amendment.
Very good. Any other amendments? Any other amendments? If not, then Who made the motion to begin with? Was it Faust?
I did.
Representative Faust, would you be so kind as to renew your motion?
I would be delighted, Mr. Chair. I renew my motion to pass House File 3790 with a recommendation to pass to General Ledger.
Yes. For additional discussion, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I stated earlier, Representative Murphy, I really, really like the fact that you left the recommendations in Article 1.
It's a little difficult.
Article 1 together. I really appreciate the recommendations. As and an outdoor person, thank you very much. I'm not sure if you want to answer my questions. They are around Article 3. You mentioned, and I believe it's a Representative Wagenius provision, you mentioned that parts of it are House File 1086, because my question was, where did this stuff come from? It's requiring the Legislative Audit Commission to fund, to use state money to fund restoration work audits. And I'm just curious, is MnDOT going to pay for the restoration audits on wetland restoration work they did in wetland replacement on highways? And where is that money going to come from? We've identified a number of restoration audits that are going to be required and hiring outside consultants, and I'm wondering who's going to pay for those and where is that money, how is that going to be allocated?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen is here and he can help if I need it, but the restoration audits are going to we're going to fund them from, you said, state money from the 3ACE funding for the 3ACE projects.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I understand that part of it. I think that's in the section 2 of the bill. If it's dedicated money, you'll use dedicated money to do the audits, and I understand that. But my concern is in section 1, this says all state funds. So we use MnDOT funds, we use Bowser, RIM, things like that. We do restoration work on private property. And are we going to have auditors coming out on the farm to look at Bowser projects to see if they qualify? And then who's going to pay for those audits? Is MnDOT on a restoration, wetland replacement project? And then Game and Fish, too, where we do a Game and Fish. Are you going to use Game and Fish funds? I don't think you can use Game and Fish funds, and I don't think you can use bonding dollars for audits.
Mr. Hansen, Representative Hansen, if you can answer the question, you understand what the question is?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, I think when you look at line 36.29 on the whole and part, and you should keep reading down to 36.30 and 36.31, where it's more specific about defining state funds. It says, including the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the Parks and Trails Fund, the Clean Water Fund, the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund, and state-issued bonds. So it's not talking there about the general funds where you are, let's say we do along the Vermilion River, a riparian buffer that's funded through a general fund. That's not the intent there. The intent is where it's including, and that this provision is relating to the funds that are named there on accomplishing the restoration goals.
And the project.
Representative McNamara, if I can interrupt a sec, I do think you raise a good point that you need to have at least some discussion on before it reaches the House floor, and that is the bond funds, because that may raise a difficulty. I think all the rest of the funds are fees that are kind of ongoing fees type thing, but the bond fund may have some difficulty with. Representative McNamara, I interrupted.
Well, along those same points, Mr. Chair, I think the bonds clearly can't be used for that, and I don't believe Game and Fish funds could be used for an audit, and that would be my question. I think there's, because on 3629, these audits are available for every kind of wetland restoration. It could be a MnDOT project, a Bowser project, a rim, any kind of a state project. It could be a state park, an SNA, state forest, I think all kinds of different situations. And is that what we mean in this bill? Is that what we're doing?
Representative Murphy, Representative Hansen.
The portion that is from the project that's from the fund would be billed back.
If, for clarification purposes, I've, on your spreadsheet, it does show the spreadsheet of in fiscal year 11 of 66 and 36, and then every other year for 66 and 30 for those two particular funds. I want to call your attention to that. Representative McNamara, did you have a follow-up?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm going to defer to you, but this fiscally doesn't work. If it was just the dedicated fund money, I think it would be fine. I think it's a great idea to start a clean slate, but we're maybe putting requirements on MnDOT and other agencies here, and I think DNR, Game and Fish Funds. So I don't know if Representative Hansen or Representative Murphy have a fix. If we just want to do an oral amendment to make it just apply to the new dedicated fund projects, and then talk in the future.
I stand a little bit corrected that the spreadsheet applies to Section 2, not Section 1. Representative Kahn?
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, remember the chief author of this bill to do this is Representative Beard. So probably it would be best to have Representative Beard around while we're discussing this. And second of all, if you read the language on 37.3, it distinctly says when possible. I absolutely know that Game and Fish Funds could be used for this because there's no constitutional restriction on that. I'm not sure about the bonding fund. It would be depends on how the bonds were issued. But you certainly, in issuing bonds, you certainly do a certain amount of oversight and a certain amount of decision making that you use the bonding fees for. But the language, when possible, completely covers any problem that we might have with a special fund and not being able to do it. But the you know, the basic problem is, as we've put all these new activities in, we really have to make seeing that the money is used properly, which is the function of the legislative auditor. We've got to make the funds cover that, because there isn't more general fund money to just take it out and do it. So I think the language is fine, and I think we should just leave it.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe to help on that, and to go on to line 36.28, and 36.27, at the direction of the Audit Commission. This was something that we did discuss in the Audit Commission, if I put on my Audit Commission hat last year, because there was similar language. So rather than having the legislature direct the legislative auditor, we're having the commission do it. So Representative McNamara, if there was any action taken, there would have to be a vote. Unlike a traditional financial audit where there's the authority that goes with the legislative auditor, you're going to have an open meeting. If we said, for example, we wanted the legislative, if I'm putting on the we here, but if the Legislative Audit Commission gave direction that it was now time to audit the Parks and Trails Fund restoration, I'm, like any program audit, I think the direction would be there in an open meeting with a vote giving that direction to the legislative auditor. So there's an extra added layer of accountability there that may provide some of the comfort on making sure that that any type of direction that's given is clearly related to the fund and has that flexibility so that over time you may be auditing Parks and Trails Fund or Outdoor Heritage Fund or Clean Water Fund.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do believe that Section 1 was not part of Representative Beard's bill. I believe it's part of, if I heard Representative Murphy right, when the notes I made was she said Section 1 was part of House File 1086, and that Section 2 was part of Representative Beard's bill, House File 3258. We're aware of the questions, Mr. Chair. I'm fine.
Hey, Representative Kahn, did you have
I think I'm right, Representative. It's been some time since I've been on the Legislative Audit Commission, but isn't that one of the few things that's totally equal in terms of bicameral and bipartisan. There's no majority on it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, that is correct.
Okay, any other questions on the bill? Any other compliments for the bill? Okay. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I just made me a little confused here because I Representative McNamara is talking about transportation funds and in this section, and I don't see anything here relating to transportation funds other than you could extract, you know, state funds. I guess the question to Representative Murphy or Representative Hansen is, would this audit be charged back to the transportation funds? And could that be done in any way in this bill, in this language here?
Representative Hansen, Representative Murphy?
We did not talk about that specifically, and I think the Audit Commission would do that talking, but it was our, if we were doing a project from that was funded from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, say, then the Outdoor Heritage Fund would, funding could pay for that audit, for that portion that was the Outdoor Heritage Fund, not the portion that was the DOT fund, or the DOT's responsibility. And if they were doing something together, what this bill is supposed to be addressing is just the part that the Outdoor Heritage Project was addressing.
So, Mr. Chair, so...
And I imagine, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, if the DOT restoration was audited, then the usual means of funding that project would come from the auditor's office and from the general fund, not from the 3/8 fund. We did talk that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Murphy. I think that answers my question.
I have another clarification question, and maybe this needs to be clarified. If you read Section 1 in Subdivision 9 in its entirety, page 36, you are conducting, at the direction of the legislative audit, I'm comfortable with that, and it's also, so there'd be votes on it, those particular activities. And then as you go on, it says on the next page 37, lines 3.37.2, it says, restoration audits shall be funded out of the fund that funded the restoration when possible. So the when possible is where the yeah. funding comes from, but the audit comes from the first part. So you may have an audit and then have an obligation to pay for the audit, and the funding would only be possible if the funding is there. So I'm just a little questioning whether or not I'm reading that correctly. Maybe counsel can help me.
And Mr. Chair, to that point, you might run into a situation where you had MnDOT funds that are constitutionally dedicated for road purposes that would not be even available for this type of audit.
Yeah. Counsel, am I reading that if possible only is applying to the where the funds are? I may be mistaken.
Mr. Chair, that's how I would read that also.
So I think I don't think that's the intent of the authors that I'm hearing, unless I'm reading it wrong. Is that correct? You want the audit to be conducted if the funds are available, if possible, right? Maybe I'm mistaken.
Mr. Chairman, might I just...
Yeah, Mr. Nobles, welcome to the committee. Identify yourself.
Jim Nobles, legislative auditor. I think for background, as I think most of you know, the Office of the Legislative Auditor is funded through a general fund appropriation. We do a fair amount of work that is auditing of non-general fund. We audit things in the Game and Fish Fund, Trunk Highway, federal funds. We audit a lot of activities that are funded by things that are not general fund funded activities. You have already taken care of this. Over the years, you have established a policy in state law called indirect cost allocation.
It's the system that works for reimbursing the general fund for work that is done related to non-general fund activities. It's 16.A127. It's state policy. It works. I think your fiscal staff could explain this to you very well. I think that is the concept here, that, again, is just an extension for these new kinds of dedicated funds to follow a pattern that has been established in state law and works for the work of the Legislative Auditor's Office and other administrative support activities in state government that are initially funded by general fund, and then you, as a matter of policy, want those other funds to reimburse the general fund. And the way that happens is, for my office, I submit a report every year to the Commissioner of Management and Budget on the hours in our audit work that were for activities that were funded by non-general fund funds. And then the commissioner exercises the authority you've given him in 16A.127 to go in and use the indirect cost allocation system and reimburse the general fund. So I think the point here, Mr. Chairman, is we're really not inventing anything new.
Well, Mr. Nobles, I understand that, but then I will go back to the question I have concerning the state-issued bonds. And you are we're doing something additional now for restoration audits on those bond funds. And I would think that there would not be able to be a build-back for that. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, that would be my understanding. But again, I am not the administrator of the indirect cost allocation system. The Commissioner of Management and Budget is. I'm sure he would get legal counsel from bond counsel as to the applicability of the bond covenants for use in indirect costs. We actually just completed last year an audit of GO bond funds, the use of those funds, and to the best of my understanding, the commissioner did not use bond funds to reimburse the general fund for the work that we did for the very reasons that I think we all understand.
So, Mr. Nobles, does that become then just a general fund obligation?
Yes, it does, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I guess that goes back to my question about MnDOT was covered under the existing law. What I'm seeing here, there's no language here talking about MnDOT as a transportation finance committee member. We always try and guard our funds that MnDOT for the dedicated funds there, and it seems like everyone's always trying to latch on to some of those. But this language in this bill, this only affects the 3ACE funding projects. It doesn't expand to, as was being asked earlier by Representative McNamara, to transportation projects.
No, I think it expands it more than the 3ACE. Section 2, my understanding, is the 3A's. The other ones are other funds, other projects. Am I correct on that?
But, Mr. Chairman, I think it would all relate to two facts. One, what work did we do? And we have to support that with timesheet and other methods of substantiating that, in fact, work was done on activities that were funded by non-general fund. Then it would be a determination by the Commissioner of Management and Budget as to the legality of whether or not an allocation should be made to any other dedicated fund.
Okay, I think we've had great clarification on this, and we appreciate that very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Representative Davis.
I think it's taken care of by 16.A127 already.
Sure. Any other discussion on it? Okay, Representative Faust then renews his motion. That House File 3790 be recommended to pass and placed in the General Registry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And carried. No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Members of the committee, I didn't practice the answers to most of your questions, so you were very helpful. Thank you.
Representative Thiessen. The next on. Representative Rood, would you like to make a motion?
I will make that motion.
Representative Rood moves that House File 2562 be recommended to pass based on the General Registry.
Sure.
And Thiessen.
Thank you.
Thiessen, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just a second, if we. we're going to try to get done by time for the tax committee to start, so appreciate that. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill basically drops $1.7 million to the bottom line. The background on it, last year, federal government, as part of the Recovery Act, I think extended COBRA, did a 65% COBRA subsidy for people that lost their jobs for a certain period of time, and we matched that last year with an additional 35%. It created savings to the general fund because we paid for it out of the Healthcare Access Fund. This year, the federal government extended that program, and what this bill is doing is matching it. The reason is that it's spending money to match it, but we underspent what was projected to be spent on the program last year, and so we're using that savings, that underspending that was going to be spent on this program to cover it, and then there's actually some money remaining. That's that 1.783. So what basically this bill does is it extends a subsidy for health care coverage for people that have lost their jobs from 9 months to 15 months, and actually saves us money as a state overall because people aren't coming on to public programs, or we're spending less money on public programs. We're keeping people in the private sector, in private insurance, and that's about as good as I'm going to do explain that bill to you today.
Okay. Questions? Any questions? We always like it when you come in and save money. No. Very good. But it's not in the general fund. Well, we may have to make an appropriation. Huh? No. Okay, Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, so then Representative Thiessen, basically they're using their COBRA coverage to, and we're helping pay for that to just keep that private insurance in place.
That's right. That's a very easy, much easier way to say it. We're helping them keep their COBRA coverage instead of coming onto public programs. We're subsidizing their COBRA coverage.
When we say subsidize, are we covering it all, or just based on any income they may still have, or
it's Mr. Chair, it's only for people that would otherwise qualify for public programs.
I see.
Yeah, you're right. And then we are paying 35%. The feds are paying 65%. So in essence, we're covering it all as government. The state share is 35%.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, if we can save money doing this on these types of scenarios, why don't we transition some of our programs into these private coverage and just subsidize the premiums? Wouldn't that make savings wider spread for these programs?
We are, Mr. Chair, we are saving general fund is what I should have said. We're actually spending healthcare access fund to do this. So we're saving general fund money. We're still spending the money.
So it's, Mr. Chair,
yes.
It's not an actual, is it a net savings?
It is
to the general fund, or is it a net savings to both funds overall because it's cheaper to subsidize their private health coverage than to have them come on the public health coverage, and that would cost more, is how I understood your first comments.
Mr. Chair, it is actually savings to the general fund, not overall. The health care access fund is expending more than this general fund savings.
Okay.
Yes.
Other questions? If not, then Representative Rood renews her motion that House File 2562 be recommended pass and placed in the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And carried.
Thank you.
And we have one additional one. Members, if you would save Representative Winkler's 2754 in your packet or have it available, keep it in the green thing. It'll help the staff. The next one then is House File. Representative Rood, do you want to make a motion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 3046 be recommended to pass and pass the General Register.
And Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr.
Bring your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3046 is a bill to license birth centers. A birth center is a facility licensed for the primary purpose of performing low-risk deliveries that is not a hospital. Research confirms that for the appropriate patient, birth centers offer a safe and cost-effective way to provide care. I want to note that this is timely as the federal health care bill that was just signed into law guarantees facility payments to birth centers. Currently in Minnesota, we have two birth centers that are in the process of coming online. Current law does not regulate birth centers. This bill seeks to license birth centers and thereby setting a standard of care. This bill states that to be licensed, birth centers would have to go through a rigorous process and become accredited through the Commission for the Accreditation of Birth Centers, CABC, which is highly regarded. And, Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment that I need to.
Pardon?
I do have an amendment to move to get my bill in the order.
Okay, there's an amendment before us. Representative Rood, is it the A7 amendment? Is that
yes,
correct?
Mr. Chair. Yeah, thank
Representative
you.
Representative Rood moves the amendment H3046A7. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what this, we've had ongoing discussions as this bill has been moving through the process. What this amendment does is currently, or historically, midwives have been paid at 65% of the rate as physicians. The federal law that just passed now allows midwives to be reimbursed at 100% of the rate, so we are just conforming to that. So that is the one change. The other change in here, strike page 6, line 20, deleting or postpartum care. This bill spells out what would happen if a woman were at a birth center and needed to be transferred to a hospital. This would just, deleting our postpartum care, that simply allows if a woman does have to go to a hospital ultimately to have delivery, she can still return to her primary prenatal care provider for her postpartum care. And we are deleting Section 6, and that is because we just want to make this a clean licensing bill. And I do have an oral amendment, if I may, to add to this. It's fairly easy, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Well, is it the oral amendment to the amendment?
It's just it's one additional deletion
okay.
of Section 1.
Well, let's why don't we adopt the A7 okay. amendment first? Everyone is okay with the A7 amendment? Understand it? Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed and carried. And then your oral amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just delete Section 1. And again, in some discussions, what this did is it listed birth centers as an essential community provider. And we are just going to eliminate that for now. We are continuing to have some discussions. There's some thought that the federal legislation makes this somewhat redundant. So we just want this a nice, clean licensing bill.
So Representative Rood has an oral amendment that says on page 1, delete Section 1. Okay. Any other discussion on it? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. And the members, your fiscal note in your packet, I think, has a savings of $10,000. We have a preliminary fiscal note with the A7 amendment on it that drops down to $4,000, but it's still a little bit of a savings.
Yes.
$6,000.
That's correct.
So, Representative Aber?
Well, just the fiscal note, Mr. Chair, and this bill is going to save considerably more money than that.
The out years, yes.
Oh, yeah, well, and as it goes on, but just in terms of this option for women to have another choice in their birth, it's less invasive. The outcomes are sometimes considerably better without the interventions, and perhaps the Root has done a good job on this, and it's a really quality piece of work, so it should become law.
Well, good. Any other discussion, Representative Holbrook?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Root. If you know how many babies each year are born in the state of Minnesota, and then what number of them are paid for by tax dollars or public health programs?
Can someone ask?
Thank you, Mr. Question? Chair and Representative Holbrook. I don't have the answer at the tip
of my tongue, but I could read your whole fiscal note and probably extrapolate it backwards, but I'm sure somebody put all these figures together.
You can identify yourself for the tape, please.
Hi, my name is Cheryl Heitkamp. I'm a certified nurse midwife starting a birth center in Minneapolis. Mr. Chair, I believe the answer to the question is approximately 41% of women who receive pregnancy care in Minnesota are getting that funded publicly.
And
is that your question?
Mr. Chair, do you know the total number of births each year in Minnesota? Is it like 25,000, I think?
Seven county metro area, I think, is 47,000.
So maybe it was 25,000 births a year we're paying for with tax dollars.
Maybe not.
Maybe that's what the figure is.
25%. Okay, Mr. Chair. It sounds like, Representative Holberger, I'm getting some help from the department. It sounds like $25,000 per year.
Are paid for by public assistance, medical care, whatever.
Yeah.
All righty. Thank you.
We have one other question that we need to deal with on this bill. It was just brought to our attention by the fiscal staff. So, Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rood, members, I believe the health department actually, the fiscal note shows that there is a revenue of $9,000 in the state government special revenue fund and then spending of $9,000. I believe we actually need an appropriation to the Department of Health of the $9,000 to make this work. So we would need to add a section at the end that would say section, well, with the renumbering of the sections, it'd be a new section, and it would read appropriation. $9,000 is appropriated from the state government special revenue fund to the Commissioner of Health for the purposes of this act.
Okay, I would make that.
The fiscal note shows a spending of $9,000. It's just that they can't spend it without our authorization. So, questions on that? So,
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Marks, then does it require each year to reappropriate that?
Mr. Chair, if we appropriate it in fiscal year 11, it'll get worked into the base for the future, and the base will be slightly lower at $7,000.
All right. Thank you.
We'll have to appropriate again in future years, and it would be probably in the Health and Human Services bill, and it would just be built into the appropriations in there.
And so we'd lose the special revenue accounting of it, or?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, it would remain a state government special revenue fund appropriation, but it would be appropriate. It would be built into the budget base and come as part of the governor's recommendation and presumably be picked up in the bill that way.
Okay. Everyone understands the amendment. The chair would move the amendment that the fiscal staff has indicated. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed and carried. And any other discussion? And Representative Rood would renew her motion that House File 3046, as amended, be recommended to pass and place on the general registry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed and carried. Members, tomorrow after the session, we're going to try to our best to do several bills depending upon time. We've visited with Representative Holberg and trying to get out of here at 4:35 o'clock time frame, if at all possible, with due respect to the Republican convention that's being taken place as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, we were just assured by the majority that we would be treated in the same way, and with that assurance, many of us made plans for tomorrow evening to prepare for our convention, which actually starts Thursday, not Friday, and we recognize we don't have the travel issue, but we are starting on Thursday.
We will try our best to accommodate.
I don't know how long you're going to have Republicans available tomorrow.
Well, members, we want to start. One of the things that happened today is we were 20 minutes late because we couldn't get a quorum. So when we announce it, if you could come right away, we will deal with the Health and Human Service bill first to get that out. And then if we have time, we will deal with the pension and the Winkler bill and the
budget resolution
has to be dealt with tomorrow. That's only a few minutes, hopefully. And then there's the Wagenius bill, the Environmental Natural Resource bill as well. So one of the things is just to see if we can get started on time, and we'll accommodate that.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
I was just going to say, on the Health and Human Service bill, and I'm encouraging my side of the aisle in finance, we're starting at 8 a.m. in the morning to try to get that bill out by 10 o'clock. So if both sides of the aisle can restrain themselves on amendments, because we have to re-refer it on the House floor to Ways and Means. So that would help greatly in terms of meeting the time schedule that the chair outlined. I know most of you are not on that committee, but
okay, if you can talk to your colleagues. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much for your attention.